You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. We'll be hearing today from Helen Marshall. She'll be talking to us about the new Centre for Science Fiction and Fantasy that's just been launched at Anglia Ruskin University. And we'll also hear another winner from the Rock Road Library Location as Inspiration writing competition. But my studio guest today on Bookmark is playwright Sean Lang. Hello, Sean.
Hello, Lee.
Nice to have you with us. We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but thinking about the Centre for Science Fiction and Fantasy, obviously very genre based, you can have genres in playwriting as well, can't you?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I very much, because I'm a historian, I very much look at theatre through the past, and I'm fascinated by the relationship between the present and the past, between people and their memories, or the influence of past events on people nowadays, and that sort of interplay. So, I mean, you could call my writing history plays, which I wouldn't deny, but it's not just telling stories that happen to take place in the past. It's more about the sort of nature of our understanding of the past. So, I mean, I see my theatre as a sort of extension of my history work, and so it's a sort of genre like that. Maybe slightly odd and on its own, I don't know.
Would you write outside that genre? Would you ever write a farce, for example?
I'm cautious of that. I mean, I have written sort of one or two little pieces which are sort of pure comedy or whatever, but I mean the other big area I'm interested in, although you could say it relates to the same sort of idea, is the whole issue of faith and religious belief, but I mean, I think in a sense there's a sort of overlap between that and looking at the past as well, obviously of course, because so much of that is stories from the past which again have a relevance for people today. So it's about that sort of interplay of old and new.
Well, we're going to be talking to much more about that in just a moment, but we'll hear your first choice of music now. This is a gorgeous piece of music. It's Michael Nyman from The Draftsman's Contract. Why have you chosen this one?
Well, this was a piece of music which sort of got into my head many years ago when I was teaching at Hills Road Sixth Form College, and I had an idea for a play which in fact went back to my own school days, and it was a play set in the American War of Independence, the American Revolution, and this music, which I thought captured a sort of mixture of the modern and the old and a sense of the period without being actually period music, and I used it. It went over and over my head, and then I thought, yeah, I'm going to use this, and I used it in the play, and I was very pleased with it.
That was Chasing Sheep is Best Left to Shepherds by Michael Nyman from the film The Draftsman's Contract. So that's the first choice of music today from our studio guest on Bookmark, Sean Lang. Sean is a senior lecturer in history at Anglia Ruskin University and a playwright. He has written four books at the Popular for Dummies series, including British History for Dummies and First World War for Dummies. His plays are regularly performed at the Edinburgh Festival and at local drama festivals, and he has won Best New Play on a number of occasions. He says he enjoys exploring history and belief through theatre and has written on subjects as varied as the Passion of Christ, the discovery of the body of Richard III and World War I. Although, as I said to you earlier, Sean, when I wrote those down, I thought, well, they are varied, but they kind of all have something in common, don't they?
Yeah, dead bodies, basically. I like dead bodies. Yeah. Yeah, basically, if you do history, you're into dead. I mean, the Richard III one, I was too good to miss. The story of the discovery of the body under the car park in Leicester. But not just that. It was the people who had led the search were such fans of his. They were so sort of enthusiastic about him. And I thought they had a totally unrealistic idea of the sort of man that he was. And I thought, this is crying out for a play. So so we did one a couple of years ago, in which a sort of Richard the Third fan does what actually a lot of people do. You'd be surprised about this if it's, you know, it's not something you'd come across. They go to these archaeological places, often late at night, and just sort of commune with the with their heroes, or you know, whoever is there. You get, and this is a sort of well-known risk, if you like. It's one of the things that comes with archaeological places. So the idea is that she goes there to sort of commune with Richard, and she encounters his ghosts. Now, ghosts are really interesting dramatically. You can do a lot with ghosts. I quite often like to fit ghosts in. And she meets the ghost of Richard III and discovers that he is not at all how she has rather naively imagined him. It's called So Much for Buckingham is the play. And I played Richard, you see. It's
great. Of course you did.
Yes, yeah. Who could miss the chance, you know? But we did that at a couple of festivals, and it went down very, very well. You know, nice creepy play, that one. Yes.
So which came first then, the history or the drama?
It's an interesting one, because quite often I find I'm on the lookout for ideas which sort of suggest themselves, and history course is just full of good stories, or possibly just a little sort of moment. And because in a sense they're not the same processes, but the work of a historian is to try to sort of get into the reality of, you know, what happened and what was going on. And sometimes the language that historians use in describing things doesn't really convey the actual reality. They crossed a river. And you just sort of write it down, or they marched from, you know, Leipzig to Waterloo, whatever it might be. And then you've got to think, what does that actually mean if you are someone walking all that way, or you've got to cross that river? What are you crossing in, and how up is the water going to come, and so on, you know, all these realities. And so in a sense, what I'm trying to do, because history has to involve imagination, I mean, however professional and objective you are, there are always gaps. There's always something where you have to use your sort of historical imagination. And I'm simply trying to latch onto that and use theatre as a way of exploring the past. What comes first? I suppose usually the history comes first, but the theatre idea comes very quickly afterwards, and is sort of, it's not even as if it sort of comes onto the scene afterwards. It's that it's sitting there in the history, and you just have to pluck it out.
And how would you describe your theatre if we went along to see a Shaun Lang play? Is it traditional, modernist? You know, do you have people coming on pretending to be icebergs through interpretive dance, or is it?
Well, I haven't done that yet.
That's an idea.
That's an idea. I suppose in general terms, it's fairly familiar, but very often with a twist. For example, I did what you might think of as a fairly standard type of history play about the outbreak of the First World War. It was about the Vienna bit, not London. So it's about the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, and you know, the sort of thing that you find in the history books. And then I mentioned ghosts, and then suddenly you have the ghost of Franz Ferdinand coming to talk with the Austrian foreign minister, and you have a dialogue between the present and the what might have been, as it were. And I find that's a way of exploring a historical idea, because you know, you've always got the what might have been angle. And the irony there is that Franz Ferdinand was absolutely opposed to going to war in any shape or form. Not because he was a pacifist, very far from it, but he just thought it would be a total disaster, as indeed it proved. And I thought, what if you could somehow get that in? Well, the obvious way to do it is through a ghost. Now, that's the sort of thing, just as a historian in history, but you would never do. But you can in the theatre. So I quite like those sort of ways in which theatre can push the boundaries beyond what other media can do. Or certainly the medium of history can normally do. So in that sense, yes, it can be, if you like, a sort of fairly traditional type of staging or writing or whatever, but it will still surprise your expectations. At least I hope so.
I can see how the history is feeding the playwriting. Does the playwriting feed back into the history? Do you go back to the history and look at it with a new eye after you've written something?
It certainly feeds the teaching of the history. I've been told that many times. it's sort of quite a dramatic way. I think it does, because one of the things I'm particularly interested in is what is a character? You see, when you write about someone from the past as a historian, you do one thing. When you write about them as a playwright, you do something significantly different, and yet it's the same person. And then of course you have the actor, who also has to sort of embody that person, yet it's a real person. And in fact, that's something I do want to write about. And I've got a sort of book in mind here, because I think there's a strange sort of interplay between the crafts of playwright and historian in dealing with exactly the same material. And so I will, you know, I will often use historical material. Indeed, I will nearly always use historical material in the writing. But the way, the different ways in which you approach it and use it, I think they can feed each other. So they can sort of feed the history, and the history can feed the playwriting.
I'm wondering if you almost feel let out of a straitjacket when you're writing, because history is about facts and evidence, yeah, and proving, whereas in playwriting you can say, well, what if?
Yes, there is a sense of that. And I mean, history is a discipline, and there is such a thing as bad history, you know. And I mean, that's what the film Denial was very much about. And so, you know, there is such a thing. You have to be aware of that. And so, you know, one of the things we're always teaching students is, you know, how to write in a sort of objective way, using the evidence, supporting it, and so on and so forth. Yes. And yet there's always a gap. There's always a gap between the reality that you write in a history book, or indeed a history essay, and what actually happened in the past. And that's where, in that sort of open sky area where you can fly freely, that's where I like to go. And it's not escaping from the discipline of history, because I think my plays, my plays are a way of exploring history, which is valid. It's not like it's a flight of fantasy, but you can use methods which are not open to you when you're writing a history book, and a sort of an imaginative moving of the boundaries, if you like, which is not normally open to you when you're writing a sort of traditional piece of work of history. And so, yes, I wouldn't call it a straitjacket exactly, but it enables you to push outwards rather more in order to get to the same end, which is a better understanding of what happened in the past.
And how do you feel about playing, not fast and loose with facts, but playing with them? How does that feel? You know, how do you decide what facts you're going to play with?
You have to bear in mind that theatre and history are different genres. They're different things, and there are different rules. So, for example, if you go into detail on some historical event, that normally means you add more and more detail in, more and more characters. Because, I mean, life is full of all sorts of people. If you think of the number of people you encounter and deal with in the course of a day, it's a huge number. Far more than anyone who suddenly comes in to watch the drama of your life could possibly cope with. So you've got to simplify. You've got to, you know, reduce the whole cabinets down to one or two people. Otherwise, it just gets unwieldy. Not to mention the fact that each actor's got to be costumed and brought in, and if it's professional, they've all got to be paid. So, you know, the practical things mean that the playwright has to work to totally different rules from the historian. And this is why my line is always that there's no point expecting accuracy, whether it's even in film and TV, actually the same applies, but very definitely in the theatre. No point expecting accuracy. It won't be accurate, but it can be authentic. And I think there's a difference between being accurate and being authentic. And I think what I do aim for is authenticity, because you can't go for accuracy. You know, the practicalities don't allow it.
And how do you get authenticity then? Because you are aware, I'm always aware when I'm reading books about the past, that even the very words they used were different. And I'm guessing that you have lots of friends who are historians who come along, yes, to see your play, who might be very quick to jump, as indeed you might be very jump on.
It can be the language. Indeed, language is a great way into the past and in a period. I remember hearing Peter Ackroyd say that, actually, about his historical novels. And I think he's absolutely right. If you get the language right. Now, you have to somehow get a compromise, because it's one thing to get the sense of Victorian language, because we can still understand what we're hearing. If you get the sense of medieval language, you're in a totally different world, indeed a totally different language. So you've got to get something which sounds, which makes sense to our ears without sounding totally anachronistic. And sometimes you can get it wrong. I mean, I put a phrase, I remember in the First World War, one about boots on the ground. But I thought, well, no, I mean, that is very, very sort of 2000s, I suppose, even. I think I would change that. The language can do it. But above all, I think the attitudes and the assumptions. And a challenge here, and I remember I had this with a play I wrote about the atrocities in the Belgian Congo. And that is religious belief. Because most ages in the past have had a sort of assumption of religious belief, which we find very, very alien today. I mean an assumption. It was just sort of taken for granted, and people slipped into religious language and religious assumptions without any sort of self-consciousness and without anyone feeling uncomfortable or anything of the sort. Now, trying to put that across, I remember to student actors, because this was a play about people, a very religious couple, and talking with their minister and discovering in the paperwork of a shipping company the slavery that was going on in the Congo. And it was very important that their religion should be totally natural and yet very strong. And I remember the actors sort of beginning to go into sort of funny voices and sort of Mickey taking and caricature. And I said, no. Take it absolutely naturally. Don't worry about it. Think of it as natural as if you were talking about the Prime Minister. Then you get it. So that sort of authenticity, if you like, of language and attitude is more important, I think, than getting all the details of the costumes right or the particular type of Spitfire or whatever it might be. That's secondary importance. The important thing is the attitudes of the people and that the characters should be real and of their time. And then I think you've got it.
And how do you decide? Because you must see a lot of stories come across your desk as a historian. You know all these amazing facts and figures and stories. How do you decide which one of those will actually be good for dramatisation?
Well, there are many which will be good for dramatisation, but I think the one you go with is the one which speaks to you, which tells the story you want to tell. So, yeah, a lot of that will, you know, there will be stories which don't speak to me, and therefore, if it doesn't speak to you, you can't really speak it to anyone else. What I particularly like are moral dilemmas. I'm very interested in people who lie and deceive. There's a lot of good dramatic possibility there. Now, that music that we heard was from a play about a man called Benedict Arnold, and he was a phenomenally successful American general in the War of American Independence, you know, fighting against the British. And then he changed sides. And for various reasons, he got disillusioned with the American side, and he offered his services in secret to the British. So he's in America. He's known as their most famous traitor. He's not very well known over here, but he's certainly well known and notorious in the States. And I thought, that's an interesting thing. He's not just changing sides, but this is like someone like Monty or someone changing sides in the Second World War. You know, some great national hero. Now, of course, more recently we've had things like Homeland, which have got the same sort of idea. But hey, I was there first. But that sort of idea of the lies that people tell, particularly if the audience know it's a lie, but of course the people on stage don't. You know, then you get the real sense of tension. I'm fascinated by that. So I like those sort of stories where there's an element of deceit or an element of deception or something like that. So something where things are not as they seem, and quite deliberately so. Yeah, those ones will speak to me.
Oh, well, hold that thought. We'll come back to you and talk about that. Of course, you speak, you teach at Anglia Ruskin University,
do.
And we're just about to find out now about the Centre for Science Fiction and Fantasy. Are you a science fiction or fantasy man as well?
I'm not in a big way, no, though I do Doctor Who in a big way, yeah.
Yes, don't we all?
Who doesn't? Yes. But that's a whole area. I mean, that's a sort of alternative reality area, I think, science fiction, and that's a... And I suppose I'm a little bit too much of a historian to go all the way down that path, but I can join in. Yeah,
I think that might be quite hard on the stage as well, science fiction, somehow. It somehow maybe needs to be one removed from you.
I think if you go for the sort of the idea of space travel and you want to see the spaceship, then yeah, that's probably got to be, you know, in film. I say probably because there are ways of doing it on stage. But on the other hand, what it all comes down to is human drama and the conflict between humans, and that can be done on stage, you know, and doesn't matter whether it's set on the planet or whether it's set in the trenches of the First World War.
Well, let's see what Helen Marshall has to say. Helen Marshall's first collection of fiction, Hairside, Fleshside, won the Sydney J. Bounds Award in 2013. Her second, Gifts for the One Who Comes After, won the World Fantasy Award and the Shirley Jackson Award in 2015 and was shortlisted for the British Fantasy Award and the Bram Stoker Award. She's a lecturer in creative writing and publishing at Anglia Ruskin University and one of the main movers and shakers behind the just-launched Anglia Ruskin Centre for Science Fiction and Fantasy. And it was at the launch in February that I met her, and I asked her to tell me a little more about the centre.
Well, we're just launching it today, but it's an interdisciplinary research group that brings together a lot of the talent we have at Anglia Ruskin University. So we've got people who are interested in traditional literary fiction, but also creative writing, like myself, publishing as well. We have people who have worked in publishing. We have former editors and current editors as well. We also have somebody who specializes in linguistics, so constructed languages, like you might find in Game of Thrones, like Dothraki. So we bring together all of these interests, and we get together essentially to talk about the genres of science fiction and fantasy and how they're made and how they're constituted.
So what does that mean for students who might be interested in following this line of genre?
Well, it means that if they're writers and they're interested in breaking into the genre, we can give a really good, well-rounded program that will teach them about the tricks in the, of the trade, essentially. So not just how to write, but also how to publish their work and how the publishing industry works in general. But our course isn't just for people who are want to be writers. We have librarians who are going to be interested in it, all sorts of people who just really are interested in science fiction and fantasy, whether it's the literature or films, television, video games even. We have a wide variety of interests.
And how are you defining science fiction and fantasy?
For me, what connects the two genres is the sense of wonder that lies at the heart of both of them. So really, I suppose both science fiction and fantasy are genres that look at the world in a way that's different from the real world, so tweaking bits of it. Fantasy tends to look towards the past, so it steeps itself in myths and legends, whereas science fiction tends to look towards the future or alternative futures. But both of them have that sense of wonder, but also of wondering, I suppose.
And you're a writer in this field, aren't you? Why do you write in this genre?
I suppose because it's the only way that I can think of to tell the stories that I want to tell. I find the real world is actually a really, really strange place. And fantasy, which is primarily what my genre is, gives me a way to access the emotional core of the real world, but to tell it slant so that in some ways it becomes more accessible. I think if you displace things, you change parts of the world, it allows people to, it's just imaginative play, really.
It's a lot of world building, though, isn't it?
It is a lot of world building. And so it's also a lot of research, too, which to me is a lot of fun. I enjoy the bits of research. I find researching the real world is actually the thing that gives me the strangest ideas, because so much strange stuff does happen in the real world.
But you're using it to reflect back on the real world. So you're creating an alternative world that tells us something about the world we're living in at the moment.
I think that all literature is always talking about the moment that we're actually in. And I mean, I have to say, honestly, this seems like a particularly important moment to be talking about. It feels like it's changed in some ways, the way that we talk about literature. I feel like more people are going back to literature as a way to figure out what exactly is going on in the world.
I was going to say, do you think it is more relevant at the moment? Is it a growing genre in terms of readership?
I think it is a growing genre in terms of readership, in part because it has really penetrated in the mainstream in a way that it hasn't in the past. So we do have major TV shows like The Walking Dead, Game of Thrones, we have The Avengers and all of the Marvel movies on the big screen. But also at its core, I think we're in a moment where people are really trying to understand the way that the world works, and it seems as if reality in some ways has shifted. And I think fantasy and science fiction give us good tools to be able to grapple with worlds that seem alternative to the way that we thought that they were.
And looking at the faculty members here, most of them, if not all, are female. And perhaps there was a time in the past where people might have associated science fiction with men.
I had never really thought about it that way, but you're absolutely right. It's not exclusively female, but I think that the genres have opened up towards female audiences in much bigger ways. But I think publishing in general has changed that way. So we're seeing more books being published by women in general than we may have in the past.
And have you got specific events that are going to be happening at this centre over the next year?
We're having a screening of The Girl with All the Gifts by the screenplay and the original novel were by M.R. Carey, and he's going to be doing a Q&A afterwards. So that's going to be on April 4th. We're also going to be running a lecture series that's going to be both throughout the next couple of months and then starting up again in the new academic term in September. And along with this, we're launching two new master's programs. So we're launching an MA in Science Fiction and Fantasy, which is an interdisciplinary MA, and also one in Children's Literature, which I think will have a strong, a fantastic component to it.
Is there something also about making the genre taken more seriously?
I always feel like that's a battle that's ongoing, I suppose, because I think both fantasy and science fiction, which were for a long time strongly associated with the pulps, do deal with problems of reputation. But I think what we're trying to do here is really give it the weight and seriousness that you would give all literature, and that's really why we've taken it as the object of our study.
Is this the only unit of its kind in the country?
It's the only research group that's tackling both science fiction and fantasy from an interdisciplinary perspective. So there are other research groups and MA programs that are interested in one aspect or the other. But ours, I think, is comprehensive in that sense.
So it'd be very exciting if Anglia Ruskin became known as this hub for science fiction and fantasy.
Well, I would certainly like it to become known for that.
And in terms of long-term ambitions, let's think 5 years ahead. I know you're used to, as a science fiction writer, thinking further ahead than that, but 5 years ahead, what would you have hoped to have achieved by then?
I would like to have an amazing crop of students who have graduated by that point and are hopefully becoming scholars in their own right and publishing their own novels. That's what I would love to see.
And just one final question, in terms of science fiction novels and fantasy novels, what are your favourites?
Oh, that's always a really hard one. I read Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel recently, and I enjoyed that very much. And I suppose right now, one of the classics, I suppose, would be The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood, which seems particularly apropos.
Always a good one, The Handmaid's Tale, Margaret Atwood. That was Helen Marshall there talking about the Centre for Science Fiction and Fantasy at Anglia Ruskin University. And if you want to find out more about that, the website is csff-anglia.co.uk. Studio guest on Bookmark is playwright Sean Lang. Sean, Helen talking there about how she uses fantasy and science fiction to reflect back on current issues. And I guess you do that. You use historical stories to say something about today.
Oh yes, very much so. In fact, I was interested there because Helen was saying that the real world is, she finds, sort of odd or whatever. And I thought that's the sort of other side of what I do, because I like the real world. And I always find that, you know, on films, for example, it will say this is based on a true story, or this is, you know. And the fact that people are watching something which in some way is true, it seems to be a very powerful sort of incentive to them to sort of go into the story with you. And I think that idea of some sort of truth coupled with a relevance. And, yeah, I mean, history is always coming up with relevant ideas, either because the story actually relates to something that's in the news, or because it says something about us which is still true, but which was shown in the past. I mean, I think that, for example, about our obsession with the First World War. I think, I mean, in some ways you'd have thought that we'd have forgotten about it by now. After all, you know, it's 100 years ago. And yet it's as powerful as it ever was. And that's and it seems to say something about us, about sort of respect for the dead, respect for the past, but also about, I don't know, we find some sort of paradigm for us against, you know, our masters, you know, the idea of soldiers simply being used as pawns in a bigger game is something which is still as relevant to us today as it was then. Or the idea of sort of slipping into some disastrous conflict because of some relatively small problem that they somehow couldn't solve. Again, that's something which, you know, if you think of the invasion of Iraq and all that followed from that, basically going down to President Bush and his personal, you know, very personal outlook, which then leads into a huge conflict with global consequences. Well, that again can certainly be compared with the way in which the First World War broke out. So I think, yeah, when people look at the past anyway, they're always looking at it through the eyes of the present, and very often find lessons for the present when they look at the past.
Well, talking about war and battle, your second choice of music is the evening hymn Last Post and Sunset. Why this one? Because it ties in with what you've written, or...?
Both. It does indeed tie in with what I've written, but also it's a piece of music which always speaks to everyone who hears it. And, you know, every year in November we hear it, and it never ceases to have that power of an incredibly moving piece of music almost wherever you hear it.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Our aspirations rather than books.
Yes. Yes, you're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers, and our studio guest today, playwright Sean Lang. Sean, I'm imagining we were talking there about writing about the First World War, and I imagine in that situation and in other situations that you write about, do you always have to have a character who's a sort of everyman figure, who's us, really, who's the audience who takes us in, and if so, how do you decide who that character is?
You do, usually, yes. I mean, I think it's not so much a choice as sort of looking along like a line of suspects or something at the police station saying, I'll have him. But it's whoever I suppose you as the writer identify with, and that will become the voice of. I mean, it may not be an individual character, of course. It can just sort of be a collective voice that comes across, but there has to be something, yes, which relates to that. But actually, so listening to that music, I was thinking that I mean, that's military music from the military, and I think particularly in artistic circles, it's very easy to caricature the military, and that's I try in all my writing, unless it is an actual comedy or something like that, but I try to avoid caricature because I think everyone is human and everyone needs to be understood. And one of the things I think with a lot of writing about the First World War by playwrights, obviously it's been a very popular topic, is to say, well, I'm not interested in the people at the top, I'm interested in the real people at the bottom, you know, the ordinary soldiers, or in other words, the everyman type of characters. And my line is, actually, they're all of them human, and the people at the top making the decisions are also human, with the same sort of strengths and weaknesses and failures as anyone else. They are put in an extraordinary position where they've got to make big decisions which will have huge consequences, but they are human and therefore interesting enough to look at, to explore, to bring out on stage. So I don't sort of run away from dealing with generals and princes and people, because they're simply other characters who happen to have rather fancy names and titles. And you know, with the First World War, I wrote a number of pieces, actually. I did one which was a sort of collection of readings about Cambridge in 1914, which was for 2014. And then I set off on something which I'm still writing, still working on, because it's a big project, this, to have one play for each year of the war, focusing on a key decision that was taken. So the 1914 one, which was called Assassination Before Lunch, was about the Sarajevo assassination and why it was that led to a declaration of war. And then the 1915 one, which we just did a few months ago at the Mumford Theatre, was about the decision to sink the ship, the Lusitania. And because what that did was to raise questions about what is warfare, who are who are combatants, are civilians legitimate targets in war, and if they are, what sort of a people have we become, what sort of a world have we created. So, I mean, there, all the characters on the ship, if you like, were, you know, could have been any one of us. And so we are also caught up in this, and yet also the officer who fired the torpedo, and indeed the politicians who took the decision, who also had their families. I mean, there's one moment in that play where Admiral von Tirpitz, now Admiral von Tirpitz is a character in the history books, he looks wonderfully like a sort of caricature German officer, because he had this big bald head, enormous beard which came down sort of in two spikes, as it was, a big fat man as well, physically. And he took this ruthless decision to sink any ship that moved, regardless of which nationality it was. Now, he's a character who you wouldn't normally think of as a sympathetic character at all. He's a sort of typical German admiral, well, German general, but that sort of high-ranking German officer sort, crying out for caricature, you would have thought. And what I did was latch onto one little detail. I read his memoirs. Strange things, because his memoirs were all about his strategic decisions. I could hardly find any details about his family in his memoirs.
That's interesting, isn't
it? You know, in itself, I thought, wow, that's an interesting thing. But eventually, by sort of reading about round a bit, I did. And I found that not only did he have two daughters who both went to Cheltenham Ladies' College, which again comes as a surprise, and I managed to slip that little bit in, but he had a son who was a naval officer who'd been taken prisoner during by the British. And so I gave him a tiny little bit. It was, here you are, you asked about playing fast and loose with the truth. I invented this. I had him writing a letter to his son. I mean, it's not a major invention, I'm sure he did. And I then just wanted him to be overcome by emotion. I wanted us to see the human side are even of this apparently sort of ruthless caricature of two-dimensional German officer. Actually, he's not two-dimensional. Well, all of us three-dimensional, and he has his emotions. And just for one little moment, they came through, and then you see he too is a victim of this war. So I've done two so far. The next one is the 1916. It's got to be about the Battle of the Somme, and therefore it's got to be about Field Marshal Haig. And Haig, of course, is our British homegrown caricature general. He's a caricatured in Oh, What a Lovely War. He's the real figure behind General Melchert in Blackadder. But again, here's a man. He wrote to his wife every single day. His letters are all up in the library in Edinburgh, the National Library of Scotland in Edinburgh. He was a man, again, of deep religious faith. And he had a very strong relationship with military chaplain, that's the phrase I was looking for, who again had a rather unorthodox approach to Christianity. He's a much more interesting man than the caricature. And once you get beyond the caricature, I mean, caricatures are two-dimensional. I find them very dissatisfying. But the real figure, much more interesting. And he was passionately sort of a believer in his men and concerned about their welfare. I mean, he's the one who's behind the poppy appeal after the war. It's called, for years, it was called the Haig Fund. I mean, I can remember as a child that those letters were written on the little black bit in the middle of the poppy. Not now. I think it says poppy appeal or something now, but they got rid of the Haig name. And there's not actually a contradiction between the man who sends them over the top at the Somme and the man who's so caring for them after the war. There isn't a contradiction, but there is a paradox. Now you see we're into very interesting dramatic territory. So that next one is going to be a rather intimate portrayal of the first John the Somme. But you do have to have someone at the ordinary soldier end as well. Otherwise, you don't really see it. And then we'll look at Russia. We'll look at the collapse of the war, the end of the war. And the most important, the peacemaking, which is the 1919 one, because that does have implications right the way through, not only to the Second World War, but actually to the world we're in today.
Oh, well, you must come back and talk to us. That sounds fantastic. Well, we're going to hear now from another winner from the Rock Road Library Location as Inspiration Writing Competition. This is someone at the beginning of their writing career. The competition was aimed at children and young people under the age of 16. Entrants were asked to write a poem or short story about a place in Cambridge. So we'll hear The Scarf Man now by Hannah Yokoyama King. This was a winner in the 12 to 16 year old category, which was judged by YA writer Julian Sedgwick. So again, this is The Scarf Man by Hannah Yokoyama King.
So this was it. It was a damp Saturday. Crowds, tourists happily bustling along the streets of Cambridge. The crowd has a life of its own. The vibrant clothes shine in the morning light and people move like enchanting shoals of fish. There is a chatter between the sellers and buyers on Market Hill. Old friends catching up, new friends made. People clutched onto their coats for dear life, overcome with the typical English weather. In the bitter January cold, I usually felt the warmth of all those bodies pressed into me. People flowed like rivers, never stopping for obstacles, but swirled around them. I could smell the perfumes, body odour and over-applied cologne. It's busy for sure, but the hustle and bustle brings life to this town. I took my place in a soft, comfy chair at the Copper Kettle that overlooks the famous King's College. The usual gentle murmur of voices could be heard above the harsh, stomach-churning sounds of the coffee machine as it struggled to produce the hot, steaming liquid beloved by customers. The sound of small talk filled the air. And that's when I saw him, wrapped in an old tattered scarf, frayed at the edges. It was a warm green and brown that reflected autumnal colours even though it was a misty cold winter. Everything else about him was dark and miserable, as though the only colour to him was his scarf. Who could ever be miserable at a time like this? I frowned at the arrogant thoughts that drifted through me as I sipped my warm hot chocolate, melting insides with warmth. Maybe he had just had a bad day. Maybe he had lost some paper that was due soon. Curiosity ripped through me, and I felt determined to make him happy on this brilliant wintry day. I peeped around. Slowly my eyes darted to the small stool that he sat on only a few seconds ago. But he was gone, leaving his scarf abandoned. My gloved hand yanked the scarf as I made my way into the icy street. Weeks ago the mud froze solid, as hard as any rock. Now it lay covered in a blanket of pristine white, and I struggled to make my way through it. I wrapped up in a long, thick coat, and still the cold air penetrated right through to my skin. My eyes adjusted to the hordes of people that walked up and down the street, heads bobbing up and down. The thought of ever finding that brown-haired boy drifted out of me. How was it possible, in this crowd of anxious shoppers, busy workers and joyful tourists? I made my way onto Trumpington Street and the Fitzwilliam Museum. I thought to myself what fun it would be to just peep inside for a few minutes. I made my way up the huge stairs and through the doors. It had endless rooms of exquisite detailed mouldings in gold and high varnished wood parquet flooring. I gaped in awe at the pretty china and numerous statues and made my way up to another collection of stairs. I spotted him, all black and miserable, but this time I saw his whole face. It had no life, no sparkle. No colour tainted his cheeks, no trace of a smile. As his colourless eyes slowly met mine, they were filled with hard, cold anger. He left the museum in a rush, as I was left in shock. It was still morning as I sat outside the museum, eating the remains of my breakfast. What am I even going to do with this scarf now? Leave it? Donate it? Who would even look twice at an old tattered scarf like this? It was obvious. He left it there for a reason. And me, being an idiot, I picked it up and rushed after him just out of curiosity. It wasn't for his well-being. It was all for mine. Guilt started a twist inside of me. Why? Why was I even here? And then suddenly my guilt faded away and was replaced with panic. I was meant to be meeting my friends to go to that new restaurant near a river, the one they always went on about during classes. I gathered my things in a mad dash and glanced quickly at the clock. 11:30. I felt a surge of adrenaline. The steady thump of footsteps echoed in my ears and I felt a bead of sweat roll down my forehead, causing my hair to stick. It was so nearly in sight, so nearly. When I reached the next turn, I allowed myself a quick glance backwards. Phew, nothing dropped. I quickly made the turn, and in a mere 2 seconds, I felt another body collide with mine. In shock, I lunged my bag at the stranger, who fell down onto the hard, cold concrete, my large bag draped over her. Her? Oh, my God, Suze! I cringed as I stood dumbfounded on the street right next to our meeting point. My best friend slowly made her way up from the floor. Well, you made it just in time, grinned Suzanne, her dimples showing. Suzanne and I arrived at the crepe affair a few minutes late. Levine, Mayer and Caddy were already there, saving us a booth, talking animatedly. Levine was gesturing with her hands and they were all laughing. Hey, Levine said, grinning at us. Quite a show you put on there, Rose, her eyebrows raised. My cheeks flushed with heat and embarrassment. Isn't it gorgeous here? Gasped Mayer. Caddy went on to describe the endless possibilities of this cafe, and I soon found myself laughing at her descriptions. Oh, here they come, Levine exclaimed, pointing to a figure slowly moving towards us. Brown hair, colourless eyes. My stomach did a backflip, and I found my heart was pounding, a strange, tense rhythm in my chest, and my hands were clammy. What do you wish to order? His dull voice echoed. 2 strawberries and cream, please, perched Levine and Caddy. Oh, make that 3, please, added Suzanne. Banana and chocolate one for me, please, smiled Mayer. Silence came after that. Rose Johnson, what do you want to eat? Shouted a voice. I looked up to find 5 pairs of eager, curious eyes gazing into me. Oh, could I have the cinnamon crepe, please? I whispered. I heard the sound of a pen tapping and clicking, and then slowly the footsteps faded away, and he was gone. Bit miserable, wasn't he? Caddy whispered to us. Kind of makes you feel sad about yourself. I decided to go for it. I saw him in a cafe shop. He seemed down and miserable and about done with life, I said as my friends all looked up in shock from their food. He left his scarf, and I thought it would be a nice idea to find him and cheer him up while giving him his scarf back, and when I did find him, he looked at me with so much hatred. Ugh, I just don't know what I'm going to do with this scarf now. Throw it away like the trash he is. You only wanted to do a nice thing, shrugged Mayer. Maybe you should go and talk to him if you're that worried about it, whispered Levine, patting me on the back. Oh, there he goes, said Caddy, pointing furiously at the window, and I could see his figure bobbing up and down. Go and find him, Rose, and give him that scarf back, Caddy said. My stomach dropped and for a moment I thought I might be sick, but I pushed that thought away. It was so windy. I tried to claw my hair around my ears, looking for the dark figure. and that's when I realised he was on the other side of the street, walking in a mad dash. He saw me. I crossed over the road with the usual crowds, trying to think of the best thing to say. But how long have I been walking now? It seemed like such a short time with all those questions burning inside me. And then I see him. I see him make his way up to a cemetery, his eyes filled with the same dullness. So here I am, bitterly cold and humid. Such an enchanting combination. Every surface, every blade of grass and twig is growing long ice crystals, 10 or more millimetres in length. I gaze into him. I see the low fog that clings. I feel it, winter's breath on my skin. "What do you want?" he asks. The wind rips the words from between us. "I wanted to return your scarf," I frown. "I didn't mean to do no harm. I just thought it would be a nice thing to do." "That's your scarf," he smiles. "What?" My hands are shaking. "It's your scarf." "Look at it again," he blinks. And I see it. My name. Rose Lily Johnson, carefully written on the tab. "I don't get it. How? Does this even..." Tears start rolling down my face uncontrollably. The dark figure moves towards me. "I'm your fears, Rose. You thought the scarf was mine because your whole life you've been scared, scared to control it. You could never control it because I keep running away. Fear, fear keeps running away." I shake my head uncontrollably. "If you keep running away, you'll only find yourself at a dead end. You can't let fear take you over. You have the chance to stop your fear from carving into you. Can't you see it?" "Yes. I've always been fearful, and it always takes me over. Panic and confusion. You want to control it, but you never can. It's always running away from you, impossible to reach, impossible to catch. I just wanted to return his scarf, but I've only found myself digging into the unknown." Slowly, but gently, my hands stroke the scarf, understanding why it's all tattered and miserable. It's been wanting to be controlled. I now understand why I got that sudden urge to talk to him, to make him happy, to make me control my fears. I wrap the scarf around my cold neck. Twice I wrap it around. The ghostly figure which has appeared in front of me only a few seconds ago disappears, and I smile to myself as I stroll down the cemetery towards the entrance. No more than an hour ago, the sky was painted with hues of red, orange and pink, but all the colour has faded, leaving only a matte black canvas with no stars to be looked upon. But it's okay. I'm not scared. After all, I can finally control my fears.
That was The Scarf Man by Hannah Yokoyama King, and it was read by Helen Holgate. Sean Lang, they're not afraid of tackling big issues, are they, young writers?
No, they're not. Actually, I like writing for young people, actually. I mean, that's sort of more or less how I started, because I was a teacher to start with, and I think there's a sort of exuberance and, yeah, the willingness to take on big things that young people have, which is always refreshing.
The lack of inhibition.
Yeah, that's right. A bit exhausting, mind you, as well it can be. But
sadly, we're coming to the end of our time with you on Bookmark. We'll come back to you in just a moment so you can talk us through your last choice of music. But on our next show, our studio guest is environmental campaigner and the former head of Friends of the Earth and a writer, of course, Tony Juniper. We'll also be talking to crime writer Alison Bruce about her latest novel, Cambridge Black, and hear more winners from the Rock Road Library writing competition. Before we hear what your last choice of music is, Sean, just a quick question we ask all our guests. What are you reading at the moment? What's on your bedside table?
I'm reading a couple of history books, actually, about the Nuremberg trials.
Oh, nice.
Yes. I'm a historian after all, you know.
Bit of light relief.
But I mean, that was inspired by that film Denial and that whole issue of, again, truth, you see, truth and lies. And I'm interested in, you know, these powerful figures, these big, huge, great Nazi names who were reduced to very, very ordinary men. I like that. That's an interesting one. There might be a play in that.
Sounds like there's definitely a play in that. So your last choice of music, Over the Rainbow by Eva Cassidy. Why this one?
Yes, well, it's such a beautiful piece anyway. And the song itself, the sort of story behind the song, it never ceases to speak to people right the way back to The Wizard of Oz and Judy Garland singing it. You know, for the American people at the time of the Depression, and it's their sort of hopes and dreams and what have you. And I think it's spoken to all generations since, that sort of yearning for something better. You don't really know what. And you know, this is a film. This is a song which inspires me. It's in my head a lot at the moment. I haven't yet written the thing which is going to come out of it. You see, so it's. I mean, that often happens. I get a piece of music and it sits there until it's ready to be used. And this one is sitting there, and I think it's a beautiful piece.